What up?
Hello. Hello, Liz.
Hello, everyone.
Hello, Edward Nichols.
So just FYI, the email that came out today said that the seminar started at 1:30. So you may have a lot of people joining halfway through.
Well, that ain't right.
And one place it said 1 and another place it said 1:30 in the subject line. So I'm glad I checked early.
Oh, right. Shit, I didn't type 1:30. Yeah, I send it, if I send it my, I'm supposed to send these through CARE. That's what Anita wants me to send them through CARE. So when I send it there first, then they have free will to whatever for sharing it faculty staff. So who knows?
It doesn't matter because I'm here.
Exactly.
I didn't fall for the 1:30.
I did. Thanks for pointing that out. Nothing I can do about it now. And I'm sorry about that to Liz if I made the mistake, which is certainly possible.
Are these Friday faculty things recorded?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. As a matter of fact, we're recording right now.
Oh, then I'm sorry.
Don't be sorry. The Faculty Friday thing came out twice. The one I sent at 12 o'clock had 1 o'clock, both in the subject line and in the email. The one that CARE sent out went out at 12:30, 40 minutes later. So let's hope everybody saw the first one. And there's Clemisha joining. Right on. Popcorn sounds good, Tracy. Are you really eating popcorn for real? Yum. I just had a peanut butter, honey, and banana sandwich, which is a good stick to your breakfast. One of our favorites when we ride horses.
That sounds pretty yummy.
It is, actually. You don't get hungry very quickly again after that. Let's see your pretty hairdo, Clemisha. Did you get your new hairdo?
Yes, thank you.
I love it. It's very sassy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Looks great.
Did you notice my new hairdo?
I did. I wanted to say something, but I didn't want to make you uncomfortable.
Well, thank you for not doing
I'm just glad that Ed got to get the chat state background that didn't say register now finally off.
Right. That's funny. Two people in the waiting room. Let's let them in. Skylar and Randall. Both there. I am doing all my work from bed today, and I don't care who knows it. So there we go. This is my fourth day dirty hairdo. So
I love it.
You'll like it. So there you go.
You look marvelous.
Thank you, darling.
And it's on the recording.
It is. Again, don't care. It is 1 o'clock. I'm going to let Liz make her decision when she wants to start. We can give it a couple more minutes, or you can do, there's two more people in the waiting room. Chris Willis and Who's M. Wood? Mark? Would Mark Wood be coming to this? Do we know an M. Wood? Well, I'm fixing to find out. And if nobody we like, we're throwing their butts out again. Okay. Hey, M. Wood, who are you? Are you Mark Wood?
Yes, Sean, it's Mark Wood.
Hi, Mark Wood.
How in the world are you?
My gosh, I'm a little crazy.
It happens.
So glad you're here.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, come on. Come on. Inviting the dog up on the bed.
Is it Smith?
No, it's P.
Oh, okay.
Well, Elder P.
It's one of the two old ladies. And there is Dr. Holland joining us. I think everyone understood the 1 o'clock thing. What does Chris say? Been chasing dogs that got out. Ooh, I hate that. So they're all safe. Good. I like this, Chris. I've never seen you with that before.
It's a lot. There's a lot of white in there.
It's nice. I like it. I do. It suits you. It's very outdoorsy. And we can't hear you, Liz. Your microphone is on. It doesn't show that it's muted.
How about now?
There's your dulcet voice. I love it.
Perfect. I think I'm ready.
You are ready. You have sharing options if sharing is something you want to do.
I do want to share so much.
Share away, miss.
Thank you all for coming. And I assume this is being recorded so that others who can't be here can watch it later. So correct. If you're watching this later, I'm glad you're here.
Nope.
This session is about ungrading. And in the interest of full disclosure, I have not done a fully ungraded class yet.
Okay.
But I feel really strongly about moving in this direction. And I hope that some of you are skeptical because that's what I want to talk about today. So for those of you who may not be familiar, and I saw a couple of you held up the book, Ungrading. It's one of the best-selling books from this higher education series. It's an edited volume by Susan Bloom with a series of essays about ungrading. But I first heard about ungrading from a colleague of mine, Bill Taylor, who talked to me about ungrading. And I remember my first reaction was, you're joking, right? Like, this is a joke. You can't just not grade. That's like literally my job. And I really did think that he was speaking some like way out there radical pedagogy that I would never get on board with. But then COVID hit. And I have to say that the way I think about teaching and about assessing student work has changed a lot because of the necessity to rethink what it means to do our job since COVID. And so what I want to do today is really have a conversation. I have a slide deck and I'll share some of it. And, you know, my slide decks tend to be much more about pictures and less about text. So, you know, I like to get a chance to look at something that's not me necessarily. So let me do that. And, you know, the name of this is Boosting Student Learning and Motivation with Ungrading, which may surprise you because I think a lot of us have this idea that if we don't hold grades over students' heads, they won't do anything and they won't learn anything and they'll all just assign themselves an A and be delighted with their work. And I really don't believe that anymore. I don't believe it at all. And I have some partial evidence to suggest that it's not the case, that students will not learn and that students will be unmotivated if you take away the grade. So I just want to say that in this conversation, if you feel that resistance, if you feel that doubt, please just say something. Put it in the chat or, you know, speak up, unmute yourself. You can interrupt me. I'm not going to take it personally. I want to hear what you're thinking. And the first thing that I want to ask you, and you can just put it in the chat or you can unmute yourself if you want. But when you think about sitting down to do some grading, what feelings come up for you? What thoughts come up for you?
Please let everyone pass.
Right.
But I hope they did well. Yeah.
How do you feel about the act of doing the grading? Ed thinks he needs a drink. I hear you, Ed.
It feels punitive every time, even if I know they've done well or whatever. Just it feels, that's how it feels.
Does anybody sit down with a stack of student work and think, yes, I get to grade today. This is going to be awesome. Randall says, sometimes maybe. I love reading student work, but that's not grading. It's the grading part that gets to me. So I think it's really easy to feel like reading and putting numbers and letters on papers is like the defining aspect of your job. But I'm curious if anybody got into this line of work because reading and assigning numbers and letters to student work was like, that's why I want to be a college professor. Because, you know, I think that, and I've shown this in a session before. I'll just give you a minute to look over this. I think that bottom right picture captures a lot of what our job ends up feeling like, that we just have stacks and stacks of work that seem to keep growing. And we don't get to do the things like goodwill hunting, mentoring, or finally orchestrating a class session or a learning experience. And so we put all of this effort into creating a syllabus, designing a course. We did this over the summer. We revised our courses for 7 weeks. I hope you all did that. And yet our basic document to launch this off, the syllabus, we have this sense that nobody even reads it. So like if the guiding document for what it is that we're supposed to do is the syllabus and they're not reading it, then like we're already starting the semester with a really adversarial relationship with our students. And we say things like, as I mentioned on page 3 of the syllabus, comma, you should, you know, follow APA style or MLA style or grade, you know, your assignment is due on this day. And so I want to suggest that what I'm talking about today represents a shift in mindset around what it is that we're doing with students. And it's not, what if I told you the information you seek in the syllabus? It's instead of thinking about this as a battle to compel students to behave in a particular way, you're relating to your students as humans. So I want you to ask yourself this question right now, and you can answer it publicly if you want. But I know who's here, and I know that this is not really my target audience in asking this question. If I went and talked to your students right now, what would they say you think about them? In other words, how do they perceive your feelings about them? And again, I'm talking to the crowd that's going to have students that are probably quite positive in their assessment.
So what I hear from my students, even in class and from the observations that we receive those evaluations, is one thing that I stick out is I want them to be successful. And so I probably say the word success 1,000 times throughout the course from day one to the last day of class, and even in the messages in the e-learn is about success, just because motivation sometimes in life, post-pandemic, during a pandemic, life is stressful. And so it's easier now to get unmotivated about things that's important to you or have been important in the past. And so one thing my students would say is that I really want them to be successful. And what that looks like to them, they have to deem that successful. The other thing they would say is fun. Mm-hmm. And so, and I know a lot of professors doesn't like, you know, their courses to be deemed as fun because we're supposed to make it so challenging that the students walk out with a headache, and that makes you know that they learned something. So so I'm totally opposite of that. So you probably hear from my students, they probably say that one, success, and two, that it's fun. And that's how I try to make it.
You know, and Clamisha, I think what you're saying, and it echoes what Ed said and Tracy said in the chat, this idea of a class being fun, I think, is often, it's a subversive goal. But if our classrooms are caring and supportive and fun, then our students can do more. They will challenge themselves more. They will try harder. They will rebound faster from mistakes. When the classroom is this room where you leave with a headache because you were challenged to think so hard, you're not totally convinced that the instructor believes that you can do what they've asked you to do. And you may feel like, maybe I don't belong here. Maybe I'm not good enough to be successful in this class. So one of my pedagogical heroes is a man named Jesse Stommel, who describes himself as an irascible optimist, which is my favorite self-description ever. And he has a chapter in ungrading. He also has a website with lots and lots of information about ungrading and FAQ and all of that. I had the chance to meet Jesse in June when I went to the Teaching Professor Conference. I low-key stalked him. So I waited until he showed up in the opening plenary and literally like sped walk to the back of the room to intercept him and introduce myself. And he just naturally came and sat next to me during the opening plenary, and we passed notes back and forth, and I now consider him to be a friend. I don't know if he considers me to be a friend, but we'll just assume that he does. He says that if you want to create a learning environment where students feel valued and seen as, you know, fully fledged members of the community, you have to do two things. First, you have to start by trusting students. That's his four-word pedagogy. Start by trusting students. And in the math world, my husband's a mathematician. We joke about this all the time. In the math world, there are type one and type two errors. Neither of us will ever know which one is which, but false positive or false negative. I would rather trust a student and be taken advantage of than doubt a student when they were telling the truth. Because the first one doesn't really hurt me. The second one definitely hurts the student, and it may be a student that we never get back because they just had their insecurity reinforced that they're not good enough to hack it here. Jesse Sommel's second thing after start by stressing students is realizing that fairness is not a good excuse for a lack of compassion. And for me, this is exactly what equity is all about. Equity is not equality. Equity says, I'm going to meet you where you are and help you progress. And that may mean that different students get different results or do end in a different place. But in my mind, if they have learned something and progressed from where we started, then they have learned and I have achieved my charge to help facilitate that. But the thing that's so mysterious to me is that we are born as very naturally curious creatures. We are hardwired to want to understand the world around us. And you don't have to do any work to get a small child to learn stuff. Anybody who spent any time with a toddler or a kindergartner knows that they're going to say why to the point of driving you insane. Okay, we crave understanding. And yet somehow by the time students get to us in, you know, higher ed, some of that curiosity has just been lost. And I think it's a lot because education reinforces kind of the drudgery of learning. So the assessment, nitpicking every single aspect of what they're doing. And we've taken out the wonder of learning. And that's why I love what so many of you said, Tracy, Ed, Clamisha, I know the rest of you, you guys are also fun teachers. The joy of the classroom should be seen as a feature. We should all be excited about learning because it represents possibility. It represents opportunity. And when we can bring that into the classroom, our students benefit and we benefit. But when we reduce learning to this idea that I have knowledge and I need to plant it in your head, what many people call the banking model of education, that's not joyful, right? That's a knowledge transfer. I just want a USB that I can hook up to someone else's brain and just do a file transfer, right? There's no joy in that. And the other thing that I think about a lot is that I don't know what a student is thinking on day one, and I don't know what a student is thinking on the last day of the semester. What I know is what they choose to share with me, and they're sharing that based on what they think I want. It all comes back to control, and I think that control over learning harms curiosity. It harms achievement. It harms the willingness to take risks, and it moves us from learning to performance. And I don't personally see college as a place that teaches people how to perform. I see it as a place for people to learn and grow and challenge and experiment and develop skills. But how they choose to perform those skills is going to vary depending on their own goals. So at its core, ungrading is all about recentering learning and the things we actually care about and decentering extrinsic rewards, punishment, the like mechanics of everything. All of those things that can dampen students' enthusiasm for the sake of learning. So things that go wrong with grades, they fail to communicate feedback. There have been a number of studies that show that if you give a student an assignment or a paper and it has a grade and feedback, they read the grade, they never read the feedback, nothing changes. So what have they learned? They learned that this was good, so I should keep doing it, or this was not good, so I need to do something differently, but I'm not really sure what, so I'm just not as good as I thought I was. We know that the higher the stakes for any particular grade, the higher the reward for cheating, and the lower students intrinsically feel motivated to achieve. So exams that are worth a large portion of their grade, assignments that can't be revised, those kinds of high stakes assessments actually subvert our goals to produce lasting learning. They hurt our outcomes. Grades pit students against each other and against the instructor, which undermines belonging, undermines community, and undermines the student's willingness to speak up when they have an issue that needs our support. So if your students are afraid of you, I know some people are like really proud when their students are afraid of them. I remember once early in my teaching career, a first year faculty member came into my office and said, "I did some good professoring today because I called on a student and asked them to tell me what the reading was about and they couldn't. And I told them that they better have it right next time." And I thought, that's not good professoring, that's bullying, that's hazing, right? You've just told that student that you care not even a little bit about what's going on in their life and that they should not trust you to have their back if something happens. Randall, you said, "My concern is that students do not find me, or that they not find me intimidating." I completely agree. I don't want to be intimidating. The other thing about grades is that no two people will ever be consistent in their grading. And here I include a single person at different times, depending on how much sleep they've gotten, how long they've been grading, whether they actually had some food lately, if they're anxious, if they're stressed, if something's going on in their home life that's distracting them. We just can't. Grading is inherently subjective. And, you know, you might be tempted to think about math and science as not falling into this category. But again, my husband's a math professor. He curves his exams, and now we have inconsistency because he looks for natural cutoffs, natural breaks between the scores, and there's some subjectivity. So this is a quote from Kevin Gannon's book, Radical Hope, which we did a book club on in summer of 2020. He says, "When instructors lament to their students, or lament that their students only seem to care about what's on the exam, we fail to see that education, our emphasis on weeding people out, has rendered grades existentially important for students. So we get exhausted by students who are grade grubbing, asking for extra credit, challenging their grades, and we say, you know, I can't believe they're doing this, that you got what you got, but we've trained them to do that by emphasizing the grade over the learning. Interestingly, of the top 20 medical schools, 18 of them use only pass-fail grades for the courses before they get into the clinic because they've seen that basic science course grades have no meaningful correlation with their actual job performance as physicians. And you think about, like, you know, A&P and chemistry and biology and those classes as being so vital for admission into medical professions. I'm not a science person. I'm not here to tell that those group of people to do their job, how to do it. But if the top 20 medical schools say that there are no meaningful correlations between basic science performance and job performance as a physician, I feel like that tells us something really interesting about the role of grading in those courses. This comes, by the way, from Susan Bloom's chapter in Ungrading. So it's on page 4 of that book. So when we think about what does matter, I think what matters is giving students some agency over their learning. Now, that doesn't mean that they get to decide everything for themselves. So students, when students need us to tell them what matters and how to use the knowledge we're trying to get them to master, they have lost agency because the learning isn't theirs. It's something that they are being asked to give another person. So what matters in my class, if I have exams, then what matters is that you can answer the set of questions on an exam. So now it's not about what the student is going to use that information for after my class, which I hope they will. It's about what they need to demonstrate to me so that they can just get out of this class and move on to the next one. And I don't want that. I mean, I am conceited enough to think that what I teach is important beyond the confines of a semester. I think that what I'm trying to get students to understand can be used for the rest of their life. And so if I'm dictating why it matters or what matters, then I'm limiting how that's possible for them. Because they're not all going to be political science professors. In fact, almost none of them will, right? So like, how do I help them? I think a lot of us see students acting like this. Just want to say, all of us act like this. You know, deadlines exist. I don't know of a single person who isn't doing the work on something that's due like the day before in academia, in the business world, right? We're just in time producers because we have so much to do and our students have so much to do. So is this going to be the student's best work? If it's finished the day before it's due, I'm not convinced it will. If we want them to learn, then we have to pay attention to everything that either helps with their learning or interferes with their learning. And try to clear the barriers and grease the wheels that lead toward greater learning. That's what I believe. That's me. You might be thinking, yeah, that's great, Liz. Sounds good. You sold me that ungrading is great for you, but it's just not going to work in my class. In my division, with the amount of content I have to cover, with the fact that, you know, my students are going to have to take the MCAT, and that's really hard, with the fact that, you know, my students are trying to apply to their nursing program, and that's really hard. And also, I'm still not really convinced that students are actually going to do anything if I stop assigning grades to their work. I'm here to tell you that you can, and they will, and it can happen. And here are just a few ways. So you don't have to go fully ungraded. You don't have to say, there are no more grades in my class ever. And this is borrowed heavily from Jesse Stommel's chapter in Ungrading, pages 36 to 60 in the book, if you have it. So maybe there's just like a portion of the semester, like the first third of the semester, you're not going to give grades. You're just going to give feedback so that people start to get used to seeing like what this class is all about, and they can make some mistakes early without it penalizing them. So many of us average grades over the semester, and that really penalizes students who start without any knowledge of your course or discipline. It penalizes them for coming in as a blank slate. So maybe like the first third of the semester, you're just not going to give grades, or you're just going to do like I love minimal grading, which is a few over, right? So Peter Elbow says like, maybe you just have a 2-point rubric where it's you did it or you didn't, or maybe it's a 3-point rubric. This is strong. This is satisfactory. This is weak. So you're giving them some sense of how they're doing, but it's not a letter grade that's going to get computed into an average. I love self-assessment because we know that one of the best measures of how well students can learn is their own sense of metacognition. So how well do they know how well they know something? And this is where the reflections of the sort that we talk about in ePortfolio so often become really important. I think well-written reflections are some of the best artifacts for learning. And it's why almost everything that the students in my class do is some sort of reflection or self-assessment. So you can have them do this in writing. You can do this in a short meeting. You can also have them write a process letter where they describe how that work evolved over a period of time. So how did you start? What did you learn? How did you evolve your assignment, revisions, et cetera? Authentic assessment is where you actually produce something, right? So one of my colleagues in social and behavioral sciences, Emily Dunlap, her students did an infographic, and that was their artifact. So it's something that can be used beyond just a class. Contract grading is sometimes called specifications grading. This is generally what I've done in the last few semesters. And I'll say, okay, so you have all these options and you need to complete these things by the end of the semester in order to get this particular grade. So students get to decide, you know, what grade am I aiming for? And they have a really clear menu of what they need to do to complete it. But I'm not going to grade each individual item. I'm going to give them feedback on it. So I spend my time not assessing a grade. I spend my time giving really detailed feedback. This is good. This made me think a lot more about this. Have you considered looking at this other thing? This relates really nicely to what you did in your last reflection. Portfolios, of course, we've talked about portfolios a lot at ChatState. Those can be good ways to capture learning. Peer assessment, that's not something that I've done a lot of, but you can. You can have, if you're really tethered to the idea of rubrics, have the students make them. That's an educational exercise of its own. When we shift to ungrading, we shift our language. So instead of thinking about a score, we're talking about an assessment or some feedback. Instead of just saying, this is wrong, it's, what's a different way we could try to get at that? Or instead of trying to get a good grade, how well do you feel like you understand this concept that's one of my course learning outcomes? And I just want you to notice that this language of assessing and assessment and what did I learn and try another way, that's very supportive. It's not judgmental. It welcomes the student into a conversation as opposed to shutting down their sense that you care about helping them be the best they can. So as I mentioned, I don't teach STEM. Some of you do, a few of you do. Clarissa Sorensen Unruh is a chemistry professor who has an incredible website all about ungrading. If I could figure out how to select, I'll Google her name, you'll find her. She's done some really incredible work. I think she's got a chapter in the book as well. But a few benefits of ungrading. First of all, it reduces stress for everyone. And when you're less stressed, your brain works better, your body works better, you sleep better, you learn better. It helps students form their own learning habits that are not the ones you've given them. Because now it's about their learning, not about performing to your specific, very particular expectations. One of the greatest benefits of ungrading in my mind is that students can be so much more creative because now they're not worried about being penalized for that. They come up with some really amazing things and I love it. It promotes better communication, and that's, you know, between you and the student, but it also lets them see that you see them as someone who has interesting things to say and that you want to hear them. And I mean, I imagine that every one of you has a story of some point in your education where someone saw something in you that you hadn't seen yourself, and they told you, and that gave you confidence. And in a world of ungrading, those moments happen more often because it's not tied to a numeric or a letter assessment of their work's relative value. And finally, this just opens up so many course design possibilities. So I'm going to give you a page, because if you know me, you know that I push books on everyone all the time. So these are some books, including Ungrading. I brought with me today Ungrading, but I also brought Radical Hope, which I love, and Bell Hooks' Teaching to Transgress, which is like my heart and soul of teaching. I think they're amazing. Susan Bloom is an anthropologist, so she decided to do this book here, I Love Learning, I Hate School, in the bottom. This is an anthropology of college. It's so fascinating. I read it earlier this year. Ken Bain's book, Cheating Lessons. Ed was in a book club with a handful of us who read that. The key takeaway of Cheating Lessons is students cheat less when the stakes are lower and when the assignments are more authentic to what they're going to need to use the skills for later. So multiple choice tests graded on a Scantron are really going to boost the odds that your students are trying to cheat, because that's usually pretty high stakes and also not particularly authentic. I've never read Paulo Freire. I tried once, I made it like four sentences in, and I was like, I can't, I don't have the cognitive bandwidth to do this. But you can get most of what he says by reading Kevin Gannon and Bell Hooks. They talk about him a lot. And then I mentioned Jesse Stommel and Susan Bloom. These are just a couple of tweets from them. I love this one, this quote from John Holt: "We cannot, in any true sense, be in the education business and at the same time in the grading and labeling business." And you may not be prepared to agree with that, and that's okay, because I think it takes a while to wrap your mind around this. But that's where, over the course of several years, I've landed. So I'm going to stop sharing this PowerPoint, and I really just want to have a conversation, guys. Bring me your best skepticism. Tell me what you're thinking. Yeah, Sean.
Hey, I don't know about anybody else, but what I'd really like to hear is what you have done. Like a concrete example that says, okay, I had this one assignment. This is what I proposed. This is what I did. This is whatever, da 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 da. Because I get the concept. I'm all on board with the value. I want to try this, period. I want to do this in spring, but I still don't know how. You know what I mean? I don't know how. I don't know what this is supposed to look like. Yes, I see I have the book, and of course I see the different types of things I can do, like whatever, rubrics and portfolios and stuff like that, but I don't know. I want to see it, how it's done. I want to see an example.
So because we are at an institution where grades must be submitted, you have to submit a grade.
Right.
But so let me give you an example of the only fully ungraded course I've taught so far. And it was a Global Scholars class in spring of 2021 this year. It was my comparative world politics class. We had like 19 people. And that class, whenever I teach it, the way I've always taught it is a lot of reading and some reflection memos and maybe a final project. But mostly it's just a seminar. So we're going to read books and talk about them. And the way I did it is at midterm and at final, I asked students to fill out a form where they, and there's some examples in the book that you can look at, but I can also share mine, of, you know, what have you done? How much have you learned? How much effort have you put into preparing for seminar discussions? How much work have you put into writing those reflection memos? How much time and effort have you put into responding to your classmates in class or outside of class? And then after they went through that guided sort of process, I said, assign yourself a grade and make an appointment with me so that we can have a 10-minute conversation about it. And what I can tell you, I mean, these were mostly honors students. It was actually like half honors, half not honors, but I treated them all like honors students. What I found is that pretty much everybody did everything I asked them to, with very few exceptions. And those exceptions were because someone, you know, got fired for a job, got evicted from their house, got COVID, something like that. And when I asked them to give themselves a grade, they gave themselves the same grade that I would have, except some of the less confident women gave themselves a lower grade. So I did not have trouble with people giving themselves inflated grades. I had trouble with students who didn't feel like they had done the best that they possibly could have done and therefore hadn't earned an A. And so I didn't ask the question after that, what grade do you feel you've earned? I asked, what grade reflects how much you've gotten out of this class? How much learning you have done? And then it's not about judging myself as being good enough. It's about looking at how well they have grown as a result of this experience. And then, you know, we would have these very short conversations and I would, you know, ask them some of the same questions, like, what really stood out to you? What's had an impact on you? What are you still thinking about? And then I would say, so I noticed that you thought that your work to this point has earned you a B. Talk me through that. So Wes, thank you for asking that question, because the answer is yes. My students do prioritize work for other classes over mine. And I'm personally okay with that, because I think that one of the best skills you can get out of college is time management. And time management means doing the things that are most urgent now and doing the things that can slide a little bit after you've finished those. I, you know, just talking to my students, and this has nothing to do with how I want them to think of me as a person, but talking to my students, I recognize that their lives are incredibly complicated, and rigid deadlines and harsh grading just tends to mean that they're going to sleep less and do less good work. And I care too much about their mental and physical health and them getting the most out of the class, that I'm okay if it takes them a little longer, but I'm still gonna ask them to do the work. That's my perspective. And I understand that that's not everybody's, but that is where I have come to traversing this path over some time.
Will you ever do an entirely ungraded semester?
I think I'm getting close.
Okay. All right.
I do.
This is something I could see doing in my honors class.
I think that honors classes are always such a good place to pilot something. Right. And kind of see how it goes. And honors students are so hard on themselves. Like, you're going to have to talk them into giving themselves A's. But in my other classes, I'm doing like that specifications grading. So I do not assess individual items. I give feedback. And at the end of the semester, their grade is based on what they've done, not necessarily how perfectly they've done it.
Right.
So I want to share something, and also it's because I've been talking to Bill about some of the things he does in his classes that I find fascinating. And one is asking the students how they want to be assessed. How do they want to be measured in their learning? And after 2 weeks of talking about this for 15 minutes twice a week, the students asked, we just want you to do it the way you always do it. They didn't have the confidence that they could make a decision that it would be a fair assessment. So I've got some work to do, obviously. And it is hard because they are engineering tech students. They are very black and white. This is the right way. This is the wrong way. They do testing and examination of things like aircraft and bridges and dams, and they want to be absolutely certain that they're learning what they're supposed to learn.
We want them to be absolutely certain they're learning what they're supposed to learn if they're building our bridges and dams. So there's that.
It's true. But this particular class is a class where it's my codes and standards class. So it's more of, do you know how to go find them? Do you know how to apply them? It's not a memorization thing. It's a practical practice thing. But at the same time, I really wanted them to say, let us grade each other. The final project, let that be our final grade, because we're working on it in a team. So I don't feel like that I'm the one whole, you know, I threw out all sorts of stuff to them. And they just couldn't trust themselves to be fair to assess themselves.
And that's because they've had 12 to 15 years of being told that they can't be trusted to assess themselves. And so, you know, one of the most important things, and this gets emphasized in every talk about ungrading that I've ever been to, every book that I've ever read, you have to emphasize that this is not a trick, that I am not going to change the rules at week 5. And that, you know, this may feel really uncomfortable, but I need you to trust me. And I'm also going to trust you. And we're going to just keep having this conversation, right? So I like what Bill does, but I think Bill, I mean, he's teaching different students, but he's also just a different teacher, right? He has a facility with getting students to trust him in a way that, because he's so laid back. And, you know, we have to do something that feels authentic to us. But what I would say is you can still hold students to very high standards. It's just not part of the grade. And I think that that is much more reflective of what their lives will be like outside of college, because there are very few places in the world where you can go work. And if you screw up something, then you're done. Right? You have an opportunity. Like maybe if you do like not maintain the airplane and it falls out of the sky, maybe you get fired, but you're probably not going to be the person in charge of maintaining the airplane until you've had time to mentor and train and work up to that, where other people are going to help you develop the skill to catch yourself. And so why is it that in our classes, we demand that they be able to do something perfectly or near perfectly when they still have so many years left to get there?
Hey, Liz, I've got a question. Just a basic, if you have any advice, how do you convince faculty that it's okay to trust students?
Well, as I said, you can either trust students and get taken advantage of from time to time, or you can not trust students and not believe someone when they really needed you to. And personally, I can handle being disappointed, but I can't live with myself if I have inflicted harm on students. That's why I start by trusting students. And what I have found is that when I tell students on the first day of class, I'm going to trust you. If you tell me that you broke your knee and caught COVID and your grandmother died and your car got wrecked all within 2 hours of each other, then I'm gonna believe you and ask you what I can do to support you. And if you wanna take advantage of that, then that's gonna hurt your learning. But it's not really going to hurt me long term. Because ultimately, your learning is your responsibility.
I'd like to add that from dental hygiene's perspective, I kind of have some anecdotal evidence as to how this worked in our last year's class. Through COVID and all of that, we went to online proctoring for our exam. So we were just having students log in, show us their testing space, and we watched them as they took their exams. This, you know, there was concern from faculty of this is going to make it easier for them to cheat. But then we also saw that there were some students that did not pass. So obviously they were not cheating. But also that entire class that went through an entire year of online proctoring all passed their board exam. So we did get them where they needed to be. So while and that kind of helped us learn, okay, we can trust the students to do this, you know, what we need them to do. And they are still learning the information that we need to learn. I will add that there are some things, some ways that we grade that I think are kind of starting on that ungrading path that I didn't even realize were headed that way until I started looking more into ungrading. So if it is something that you're wanting to do in your classroom or start to even get away from like an average test score and then your number grade, for our classroom, we set a number of attempts. So when you have a test, you get up to 3 attempts to pass that test. And you can set your passing score as whatever you want it to be, 80, 75, 70, whatever you want your passing score to be. So if you didn't make that grade on that test, it just means you need more time with that information to be more competent in that information. And so the end of the semester grade, A, B, or C, is going to be based on how many second attempts did you need? How many third attempts? So if a student gets a 70, say you set your passing grade as 75, a student can get a 75 on every single test, or maybe only needs 2 retakes, they can still get an A in the course. And so that kind of got us away from averaging. And while it's not perfect and completely ungrading, it's kind of heading in that direction for the students as well.
This fall, I told my students on the first day of class that to me, a grade at the end of the semester is meant to capture what's happening inside your brain, right? So how has it changed? What have you learned? But I can't know what's happening in your brain. The only person who has any access to that is the student. And it feels really arrogant of me to think that I'm capable of designing an assignment or an assessment that's going to work equally well for every student in my class to tell me what's happened in their brain since we met. And so I just think that if, and you know, being fair and just is one of my biggest values, one of my biggest moral commitments. If I'm committed to treating students fairly and equitably, then I have to make it possible for different kinds of brains to demonstrate how they've grown in ways that I probably can't even imagine. And to me, ungrading has allowed me to think so much more flexibly and creatively about that. Because I love learning, you guys. I just love learning. And I want all of my students to love learning. And the evidence that I have suggests that they love learning more, at least about American government, when they leave me than when they got here.
Right.
And some of that is because I'm just like so excited about it all the time. And, you know, enthusiasm is contagious. But I think it's also because I really empower them to say, like, what do I want to learn more about? everybody's going to learn some basics, but then like, where do you want to go deeper? What's going to be meaningful to you? And I empower them to do that. And then tell us.
You know what I'd like to see come out of this is I would like to hear from any of you, if you decide to try some aspect of this over the next semester or so, and maybe in next fall, we'll do a Faculty Friday workshop in which several of us during that single workshop share our own personal experiences. For example, right now I have, it might be a bit nebulous, but I mean, it's there. I have a goal of doing an aspect, a type of ungrading in my honors class, which is going to be in the second 7-week session of spring. However, some of you may not try it in the spring, but you may go into planning mode and maybe trying something for the fall. And we do our workshop. You may be in the process of implementing. Maybe you're in the final stages of planning. But I'd love to hear from some of you who plan on or have already or will have by then. Good English, Sean. By next fall, the beginning of next fall, maybe I'll send you an email. Note to self, send an email to attendees. Just see if anybody's tried this and how it went, because I think faculty want to hear more about this. I've heard since setting this up with Liz, I've heard quite a few faculty comment, faculty that I don't see here today. So I know people are interested, and perhaps if there were more direct colleagues that say, hey, I've tried this too, this is my result, this is what didn't go well, this is what I'm working on, you know, whatever, I'd like to see that. So that is your job in the future, you all. If you try any aspect of this, please let me know, let Liz know, and we'll do this again for fall with some personal experiences. I think that will really help people.
Chris, your question is a fair one that I cannot answer, but my dean's here, so you can ask her.
Right.
Sorry, Lindsay, I just called you out.
I don't, oh, there she is. Yeah.
I'm here.
Hello.
Hey. So that's one of the reasons I attended this, to learn more about ungrading. And right now there's been a couple of snafus, but I wouldn't say anything terribly insurmountable. Those of us who are aware of ungrading, we all come to our work and work with students from slightly different perspectives. And so, what my core belief is might be different, or it will be different from other people's core beliefs. So, I think generally we're all on the same side. It's just a matter of figuring out how best to make sure everyone's responsibilities and needs are taken care of. So, but that's just this division. We don't deal with life and death situations, thankfully. In the end, I do think that, especially like I remember, I guess it was last week, looking at, oh yeah, I know what it was, talking about 7 weeks and the success rates of 7 week classes, if there is more of a shift to ungrading, then like what impact do 7 weeks and the ungrading focuses have on what our learning objectives are, institutional learning objectives, so our learning outcomes. So, long-term, what is that doing with our students' critical thinking, oral written communication, those types of things. That's my answer.
Yeah. Sean, you're muted.
Maybe that's for the best, you all. Really. A lot of people would really like a mute button for me. I think that answer would be, different for each of our deans. For example, if I were teaching Comp 1 and went to try this ungrading thing, I think there would be a lot of censure on that from dean and department head, but it just depends on what we're teaching.
I do think that, so the essay that I put in the chat earlier, the Alfie Cohn, it's called The Case Against Grades. And Alfie Cohn is one of the longest advocates, like long-term advocates of this. And I just think that we have a really good evidence-based case to make for how grading is inequitable and ungrading produces better outcomes for all students, but especially some of our most vulnerable. And I see ungrading as being very aligned with the work of Chris Emden, who spoke at Convocation several years ago with his Hip Hop Ed. I just think that those go together so well, because it's about, again, meeting students where they are and helping them get to their goals and being like a coach and a facilitator of that.
Hey, Liz, just as a parting shot, do you happen to know off the top of your head anybody in math that's really into ungrading?
I don't know anyone off the top of my head, but I will send you some links because I have some.
Okay, that would be great.
Somewhere. Mm-hmm. And just so you guys know, in the interest of full transparency, I've mentioned a couple of times my husband's a math professor, and he and I argue about this on the regular because he does not agree with it at all.
Well, you know, and I can understand why, because, but again, math faculty have come up with some interesting, like, I have a couple of faculty talking about, well, what if we have a department policy that a student can't earn lower than the grade they get on the final exam. And math forward just dropped that they would even consider that based on some of the conversations we've had in the past. So, and another thing I don't understand is for years, we let students have two attempts on a test, you know, and then they had to do something for the second attempt. And we discovered that very few students were making use of the second attempt. And those that did were the ones that really didn't need to. So that was just strange.
I will tell you that there's this whole group of faculty, higher education faculty, who are part of this ungrading movement. It's a whole like academic Twitter community. And they've written an open source book on ungrading practices. And that's what I'm trying to find so that I can send you that. And there's all kinds of stuff in there.
No hurry. I've got plenty of things to do before then.
Sure. There's going to be an ungrading conference, I think.
Okay.
And again, it's
anyway, this has been fantastic, Liz. Thank you so
much. That's wonderful.
Yeah, so that link that I just put in there, I think, has all of the stuff, including a link to the open source, it's crowdsourced ungrading book. But then that EdCamp conference in November.
I love the name, EdCamp.
Right, yeah. Cool. Thank you. Wow. Well, we have reached our time and actually gone a little over, and I think some of us could probably keep talking, but we'll go ahead and call it unless Liz has something else or anyone else has a question. No. Thanks so much, Liz. This is wonderful. I'm so grateful to you. And like I said to you all, I'd love to hear from you if this is something you're going to try, and let's present on it next fall, see how it goes. And thank you all for participating. If you have any workshops you would like to do for Faculty Fridays, anything that people would be interested in, then just let me know. I'll be happy to get you on the calendar. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you all.
See you. Bye.